Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 1146 of the Juice Box Podcast. We're calling today's guest Mimi. She's 27 years old, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2001, and she's been a nurse for about a year. Before that, Mimi was an ER tech for 8 years, and this is what she experienced at her job. Nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan. When you place your first order for AG1 with my link, you'll get 5 free travel packs and a free year's supply of vitamin D. drinkag1.com/juicebox. Don't forget to save 40% off of your entire order at cozyearth.com. All you have to do is use the offer code JUICEBOX at checkout. That's JUICEBOX at checkout to save 40% at cozyearth.com. I'm talking about T1D Exchange again, and I hope you head over to complete the survey. T1DExchange.org/JUICEBOX. Looking for U.S. residents who have type 1 diabetes or are the caregiver of someone with type 1. They're especially looking for you if you are a male of color, or the caregiver of someone who is. T1DExchange.org/JUICEBOX. US Med is sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast, and we've been getting our diabetes supplies from US Med for years. You can as well. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or the number, get your free benefits check, and get started today with US Med. This show is sponsored today by the glucagon that my daughter carries, Gvoke HypoPen. Find out more at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. Hello and welcome to the Cold Wind series from the Juice Box Podcast. These episodes will feature physicians, nurses, and other professionals who agreed to come on the show anonymously to share what they see in the healthcare profession. I've altered the voices of each guest so that they can remain anonymous and feel comfortable telling us what really goes on at their job. Just listen to how well the voice altering works.
My name is Beth, and my oldest child has type 1 diabetes diagnosed in October 2020.
My name is Beth, and my oldest child has type 1 diabetes diagnosed in October 2020.
If you work in healthcare and have a chilling story to tell about your experiences in the healthcare field, contact me today. I'll get you right on the show. Your story does not need to be specific to diabetes. Mimi, tell me what you do for a living.
I am an ER nurse.
And do you have type 1 diabetes?
I do. I was diagnosed February 28th, 2001.
Oh, that's a while ago. Okay.
Yeah.
You knew the exact date, February 28th?
Oh, we celebrate it.
Do you do the thing where you have like a diversity party?
Not so much a party. It kind of is just like eating absolutely anything I want all day. That's how it started. And then as I got older, I'm like, wow, it's really not fun feeling like crap all day. So now it's really just like, I'm going to have a little treat here and a little treat there and call it a day.
Celebrate yourself. So you've had type 1 for over 20 years.
Yeah, for most of my life.
I was going to say, how old are you now?
27.
Okay. How long have you been a nurse?
I've actually only been a nurse for a year, almost exactly a year. But before I was a nurse, I was an ER tech, and I did that for just under 8 years.
What does an ER tech do?
So it depends on your hospital and state, but where I was working, I basically did what nurses do, except I wasn't doing assessments and giving medications. So I was starting IVs, I could put in catheters, EKGs, casting and splinting, CPR when necessary, but lots of like task-oriented stuff.
Okay. How long does it take to become an ER tech?
So similarly, it's dependent on your hospital and your state, but I just had my CNA, my nursing assistant license, and then everything else that I was able to do, I was taught on the job.
Okay. So you went right into like a... What happens after high school? You get like an associate's degree?
So for CNA, it's just a certificate. So Some programs are like 8 weeks, some are 12. I think mine was an 8-week program. I actually started working at like an assisted living facility as a resident aide. And they were like, oh, if you go get your CNA, we'll pay you more. And I was like, okay, like, why not? It's not expensive to get. And then once I got my CNA, my best friend's mom, who was a charge nurse at our local ER, was like, oh, now that you have your CNA, you can come work for us. And like, we'll teach you all these things. And it'll be really great if you want to go to nursing school in the future. So that's what I did. It was like probably 6 months after I graduated high school, because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something with medicine, but like had no idea because there's so many different ways you can go.
Right. I guess the assisted living place was thrilled. They suggested that you got that CNA and then they lost
you. Yeah, they're like, go get your certificate and we'll pay you more. And then I was like, oh, I'm actually going to leave now, but thanks for the suggestion.
They should have said, but you have to stay after you do it.
Right.
So, okay. So you did the ER tech thing for what? Like, geez.
Yeah, it was almost 8 years. Because I kind of went back and forth between wanting to go to like PA school or even med school. Mm-hmm. But then I was working more as a tech and seeing how those roles like interact with patients and stuff. And I was like, I don't know. There's really not that much patient interaction, but I really liked the like hands-on tasky skill stuff. So I was like, I can still do that as a nurse and like help providers with those like skills and tasks and procedures as a nurse and still get more patient contact. So ended up going to nursing school. Let's see, I actually started before COVID, and then the place that I was working at the time, the ER, had mandatory overtime. And I was like, I can't do school and work with mandatory overtime. So something's got to give. Mm-hmm. And I took a break in school actually, because obviously, my job was my health insurance, and I can't go without health insurance. So I took like a year and a half break in school and just did like online general education classes to stay with it. And then went back, let's see, 2 years ago now, 3 years ago.
What pushed you to?
And finished up.
What pushed you to go back and finish?
I loved being a tech. Honestly, if it paid a livable wage, I would probably do that forever. But it didn't. I was on the East Coast and the cost of living was really high. So I was like, I have to finish something to make more money.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy with my decision actually to take a break, because nursing school is very cutthroat, especially working full-time and being in school full-time. So full-time for like nursing in hospitals, 36 hours. So I was working 36 hours a week, had 24 hours of clinical a week, plus probably close to 10 to 12 hours of lecture a week.
36, 24, 30, and 10. That's like 70 hours worth of work for the degree.
Yeah. And that's not including like sleeping and eating and going to the gym and like being a human being.
And you were working, you would have to work too.
Yeah. So it was a lot. It was very time consuming. And most nursing schools, you have to have an average of 80% to be passing. So it's not like C's get degrees, like, you'll be fine, do the bare minimum, and you can be a nurse. So it was very time intensive. And like, if you showed up late to lecture, you don't get to enter the room. And if you don't get to enter the room, you only get to miss 3 lectures a semester. Like, it's very cutthroat. Yeah. So taking a break was probably the best thing I could have possibly done for myself. And I have absolutely no regrets, even though at the time I was like, wow, could have been a nurse 2 years ago. Mm. But
when you say cutthroat, you mean unforgiving, or do you mean there are actually people out there trying to knock you down? US Med is sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast, and we've been getting our diabetes supplies from US Med for years. You can as well. USMed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or the number, get your free benefits check, and get started today with US Med. If you take insulin or sulfonylureas, you are at risk for your blood sugar going too low. You need a safety net when it matters most. Be ready with Gvoke HypoPen. My daughter carries Gvoke HypoPen everywhere she goes because it's a ready-to-use rescue pen for treating very low blood sugar in people with diabetes ages 2 and above that I trust. Low blood sugar emergencies can happen unexpectedly, and they demand quick action. Luckily, Gvoke HypoPen can be administered in two simple steps, even by yourself in certain situations. Show those around you where you store Gvoke HypoPen and how to use it. They need to know how to use Gvoke HypoPen before an emergency situation happens. Learn more about why Gvoke HypoPen is in Arden's Diabetes Toolkit at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. Gvoke shouldn't be used if you have a tumor in the gland on the top of your kidneys called a pheochromocytoma, or if you have a tumor in your pancreas called an insulinoma. Visit gvokeglucagon.com/risk for safety information.
I think it kind of depends on the program, but it does feel like they're kind of out to get you sometimes. Our clinical instructors are part-time staff, so they don't teach like any lecture or anything. They're strictly clinical. So you go to the hospital and you practice your skills and patient interactions with a bedside nurse. Mm-hmm. And some of those instructors, I think nursing is a very eat your young profession, which a lot of people know, a lot of people say they don't like, but then a lot of people also contribute to. So it was kind of like, they don't want to see you fail, but if you start to go down that route, they're not going to help you, kind of thing.
Okay.
They want you to like figure it out on your own. And that's not the easiest thing to do when someone's life is in your hands. Mm-hmm. It's really tough. I always say cutthroat, but like there's some professors that like genuinely want the best for you and will do everything in their power to help you pass. And then there's some that are like, well, if you can't figure it out, you're not meant to be a nurse.
Have you had experience, I guess, with people who take joy in the failure? Or do you think they think they're washing you out and saving the profession from someone who's not prepared and couldn't do it?
I would like to think it's the latter. Like they want strong nurses out of school. But a lot of nursing, you don't learn in school. You learn it on the job. So if you can't make it to the job, you're never going to become a strong nurse. Mm-hmm. The same people are the ones complaining about like being overworked and understaffed because we can't get good nurses. And like, you're not giving nurses the opportunity to become good nurses.
Is it a hazing?
I think it really depends on, honestly, your geographical location, because like I said, I teched on the East Coast for a long time, and that's a very densely populated area that I was in. Right. And nursing is much different there than where I am now, which is like kind of Midwest, Pacific Northwest. And nursing here is, I tell people all the time, it's so much better. The patients are genuinely nicer. I feel like we have more time to spend with our patients. They're almost healthier here because people live such an outdoors, like active lifestyle. It's just almost easier to care for them because they want the best for themselves. So my experience out here has been so much more positive than any experience I ever had during nursing school on the East Coast or even as a tech on the East Coast.
Okay. I wonder if your nursing school experience would have been different had you done it somewhere else. Maybe, right?
I would like to think so. We see a lot of nursing students in my current ER, and they all seem like very excited to become a nurse while my classmates were like dreading it.
So the process
isn't that so bizarre?
No, it's not. The process of going through nursing school makes you just think, oh, this is going to be, if this is what this was, then the job's going to be 1,000 times worse.
Yeah. And honestly, during nursing school, I thought I was going to be a bad nurse because we did all of our clinical like on inpatient units, so not in the ER, and the ER was the only thing I really knew. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I feel like I'm supposed to be doing more things, but I don't know what those things are here. And the documentation was very different. And I was like, if this, like my instructor had to keep like prompting me to do things, and I'm like, I feel like I should be better at this. Like I have a lot of clinical experience. I'm very comfortable with patients. So like, why am I struggling so hard with this? And then as soon as I got back into the ER, I was like, oh, okay, I am a good nurse. I'm going to be fine. I don't know why I felt that way in that different setting, but it's not me. Mm-hmm.
During nursing school, how are things broken down? I think people listening, you know, they go to a hospital and they expect the first person that they intersect and every person thereafter to have a complete understanding of what's going on and their needs, which it seems unreasonable to me, but at the same time, you know, what else am I supposed to think as a patient walking in? Like I come in and I have a disorder, I have a disease, I have type one, and I'm here for that. I feel like you're supposed to know, but you don't really know, right? You do. What is it that a nurse is prepared for in nursing school is my question.
In nursing school, we are prepared for taking tests. As bad as it sounds, a lot of nursing schools are just focused on pass or success rate for the boards, which is called NCLEX. I don't remember what that stands for, but it's like your national registry. You take the exam, you pass, and then you're officially a registered nurse. So like just because you're done nursing school doesn't mean you're a nurse yet.
So nursing school taught you how to take nursing school tests?
Yes.
Okay.
With understanding of basic disease processes and the human body. So your first semester of nursing school is basically like an introduction to med-surg, and med-surg is just like general medicine. A lot of the chronic things that people deal with, mostly like heart failure, COPD, and basic like taking vital signs and how to do a bed change and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Second semester, this is different for every program. It's generally broken down similarly. Second semester was med-surg 2 and maternal and fetal medicine, so like OB. Third semester was med-surg 3 and mental health. And then fourth semester for us was like critical care and ER, which it wasn't really a ton of emergency medicine stuff, but it was just like really critical thinking and like disease processes that would land you in the ICU kind of thing.
So you get a background of a general overview of what everyone most likely comes in with, and then it's learn on the job after that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I learned way more as a tech, being very vocal with my nurses and providers in my ER than I did in nursing school. Nursing school did teach me how to test questions and break them down to where if I don't know the answer, I can figure out the answer from the question. Mm-hmm. And like process of elimination. But yeah, I didn't really learn a ton of information in nursing school other than like OB and fetal medicine, because like I did not know anything about that because that's not anything we deal with in the ER at all.
Yeah.
Usually. But I struggled with that semester, the entire semester. I was not passing until the final exam. Mm-hmm. I took the final and got like a 90%, and that brought me 1% above passing.
It's funny, you're describing nursing school like an SAT prep course.
That's exactly how it felt.
Oh, okay. Have you taken one of those SAT preps?
Oh, a long, long time ago, but I have, yeah.
Same idea. Like, this is how you break down a question. This is how you figure something out when you don't know the answer to it. Like, here's how you pass the test.
Yep, that's exactly right. And like I said, it's because they want us to have that higher testing percentage in order to pass boards. Because if I graduated and like, I think it's less than 70% of my graduating class doesn't pass boards, we lose our accreditation. So they want everyone to pass boards, whether they're a competent nurse or not. They want them to be able to answer the questions correctly to pass.
So it's possible I'm getting a nurse that was just kind of pushed through.
Yes, unfortunately.
So that the institution could continue on.
Yeah.
Every time we set a rule, it seems to just people find a different way to break it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you could understand in the beginning where somebody's like, look, you have to pass at least 70% of the people to keep your accreditation as a, you know, a place that's good at teaching people how to be a nurse. But instead, it quickly turns into a business thing where they're like, well, we just got to get them through so that we don't lose the accreditation, because that's where we make our money, selling nursing school to people. Yeah.
Yeah. And I actually went to an associate's program. So I have my associate's degree in nursing versus a bachelor's in nursing. Mm-hmm. And at least where I came from on the East Coast, our school did have a much better reputation of our graduates versus some of the bachelor's programs because we had more required clinical hours. So while they are really like pushing us to just test well, we also were required to do a lot more hands-on experience time, which I think is a huge benefit even though we had more than most schools, I still think more is better, especially with my background. Like during nursing school, yeah, I had 24 hours of clinical a week, but I was also working an additional 36. So that's like another 36 hours of exposure to patient care for me. So I think that prepared me more than anything for my current job.
Yeah, I once had a NICU nurse tell me that they laugh at the kids that come out of like a 4-year bachelor's program from a private college who ended up spending $60,000-$80,000 on their undergrad to be nurses. And they're like, you could have done that in community college for $4,000. And
And that's exactly what I tell people too. Like where I am now, there's not really many community colleges, so it's not really an option here. Mm-hmm. But because I was working full time, I didn't pay anything for my degree. My hospital paid for it.
Oh, because you can't. Oh, that's right. Because you kind of went back to school while you were a med. So once you were a tech, you told them, look, I want to go back and get my RN. And they're like, we'll pay for it.
Yeah. So depending on your hospital, despite what program you're doing, I think they reimburse up to $2,500 a year for undergraduate and $3,500 a year for postgrad. Nice. But then there's some hospitals that also have like a nursing scholarship program where they'll pay for it and you owe the hospital like 2 years of employment after, mm-hmm. or so they say. Some people take their chances and leave and they're like, well, if they want me to pay it back, they can find me where I am.
Come find me? Well, they did take a risk because you screwed over that the elderly care place.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, I could blow right out of here.
I actually did leave before my time was like due for my tuition reimbursement. It was like, I think 1 year after the last payout. And I hadn't even graduated before I put in my notice because I knew I was moving. But the hospital that I was working at, I just was not interested in staying in. Like I said, the culture of like East Coast medicine or really just a densely populated area was not a great culture to work in. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be at a trauma receiving hospital versus a hospital that receives a very sick or high acuity trauma patient and then ships them somewhere else.
Yeah.
I had worked in that environment for long enough and I was like, I kind of want to be on the receiving end and like see more acutely ill or injured people. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds kind of twisted, but I really like the like critical thinking and like more sick patients.
Gotcha. My wife once described her job as like king of the mountain. She's like, everybody below you is trying to knock you off the mountain. Like just, it's nonstop. She's like, it never, ever stops. And, you know, you're in meetings and you have to say things in certain ways so that people can't take advantage of your words if you misspeak. And, you know, they're always, everybody's throwing everybody ever under every bus they can find and all just, you know, ladder climbing, trying to get up there. Well, I mean, you moved halfway across the country. I don't want to tell people where you are, but you moved pretty far getting away from all that.
Yeah, I moved, I think, exactly like 2,073 miles or something away from where I was.
So if I asked you to, you know, blow the whistle on nursing, what are the things that pop to your mind right away that you'd want to share with people that are happening that they wouldn't imagine?
I don't really see it much at my current job, but as most of my background was at my most recent previous job, a lot of nurses hate being nurses. They do the bare minimum and they protect their licenses the best they can. And they don't really advocate for their patient. They don't use that critical thinking, like prevent future problems, which it comes from both the nurse and the patient because a lot of patients don't even want to help themselves. So what are we going to say that's going to help them? So there's just so much burnout that it's tough to provide really good care. Because they don't want it. Like patients want a quick fix. They want a pill to make their blood pressure better instead of changing their diet or their lifestyle. And you give them that pill and then they go on their way and you'll see them in 6 months for some other medical emergency. Burnout is just so severe in nursing right now that it's really hard to want to provide good care. And especially in like an ER, you're surrounded by your coworkers, and if they don't want the best for the patient, like you kind of just like almost stoop to their level. And it's really hard to change the energy in that situation.
So going back to the first step of that, you said that a lot of nurses you know don't want to be nurses. So using your story to try to surmise, are we just becoming an RN because it pays more? Do you think they want to help people and they get there and they fall into the machine and the apathy and they're like, oh, what am I trying for?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of the latter, but I think a lot of nurses also don't have the like real life nursing experience that I bring with all of my tech experience. So like they don't really know what they're getting themselves into. Granted, you have your clinical nursing school, but that is so, it's like not self-directed at all. So like every minute of every day is structured. You walk into clinical and you have a piece of paper saying at 7 a.m. you go in and introduce yourself to your patient. At 8 a.m. you go do an assessment. At 9 a.m. you pass morning meds. At 10 a.m. you make sure no one needs to go to the bathroom. Like it's just so programmed into your head that everything is like a timed process.
Yeah.
That if anything skews from that, you like panic. Like there's no autonomy in clinical at all. So when you're forced to use autonomy as a nurse after school, I think people really struggle with that. Mm-hmm. So they get out into the field and they're like, oh, this is not what I've done. And I'm uncomfortable. And now I'm just going to like fall into a pattern of what everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. Cause it works for them. So it'll work for me.
If you like answered an ad that was like, do you want to work outside? Do you like having the wind in your hair? Do you like driving? You'd be like, oh my God, this is amazing. Then you realize that you're like going to ride the back of a garbage truck and they left out the part where there'll be maggots and hot bags of garbage all day. And like, so yeah, it's not quite what they think until they, and they get there and they experience it and they're like, ooh, I didn't want this, but now it's too late.
Yeah. And it's really tough too, because people think emergency medicine, they're thinking like trauma and like broken bones and all kinds of stuff. And as I'm sure everyone knows, there's like a huge mental health crisis across the country, probably the world, but we see a lot of mental health patients and it is an emergency. It's an emergency for them and it's a crisis, but like, it's not the like thrilling emergency that everyone thinks they're going to get when they work in the ER. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of homeless patients. We see a lot of patients who don't have insurance. So the ER is the only place that will treat them prior to payment. Like it's a healthcare crisis, not just a mental health crisis. Let me rephrase that.
One of the people who's been on the show already and recorded for this said that she's like, I forget how she said it. Like, I'm sorry to say this, she said, but there are a lot of nurses who are trauma whores, she told me.
Yeah, we call them trauma junkies. Okay. And like, I won't deny that I am not a trauma junkie. I love trauma, but it's also something that will burn you out really fast too. So you see the worst of the worst. And if you see that three shifts in a row, you get off and you're just like, wow, that was really emotionally taxing.
Yeah.
Like as good as you can be at dissociating, it's still taxing.
Probably like an adrenal overload, right? Like all that.
Oh, for sure.
The dopamine kick you get from it and the adrenaline and everything. And then is it like doing drugs?
I don't know because I haven't done drugs.
Very good, Mimi. There you go.
But it is very exhilarating. There's like certain a roller parts coaster. Of the job. Yeah.
Okay.
There's certain parts of the job that I'm like, wow, this must be like what cocaine feels like. Like one time I put an IV in a 6-day-old premature infant who like the IV team couldn't even get access in. I put in like a very small IV in her ankle and I was just like, wow, they stuck this kid like 8 times. I got it on the first try. I am on this high and I'm going to ride it the rest of my shift. Like I'm unstoppable. Mm-hmm. But like, then you crash from that. Like I got home and I couldn't sleep. And then I was so tired once I like came down off that high. I was like overtired, couldn't fall asleep. And then I like barely slept before going back for my next shift. And I was like, oh, was it worth it?
Yeah. And then the next day a lady poops on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or you have like a patient with bed bugs or somebody like trying to punch you. Like it's chaos all the time.
Gotcha. They're talking to you and Spider-Man at the same time. And you're like, uh-oh, this is.
Yeah,
great. I got you.
Oh, yeah, they're like trying to like get the bugs out from under their skin. And you're like, please don't do that in front of me.
And then when you get to like a regular, old, everyday, normal person who's just in there and sick, their thing is like banal. And at least it's not insane, and then they don't get the level of care that you'd love to give to them because you have all these other influences bothering you. These variables, you're a real person too. You have all these variables pushing on you. And then when you probably get a moment where it's not, oh my God, look at this amazing thing I did, or Jesus, please stop pooping on the wall. It's just like, that's boring. It's regular and you just get it done. And then you go back to this 10 o'clock, do you have to pee, blah, blah, blah. You go to the schedule, you get them out of there. And that person later probably thinks, I did not get very good care.
Yeah. And it's really tough. Again, with the healthcare crisis, we're getting all these patients in the ER that need to be admitted to the hospital. And then there's no either open beds, or there's open beds and no nurses to care for those open beds. Mm-hmm. So those patients just sit in the ER for sometimes days on end. We call them boarders. At my hospital, it's pretty standard that you have four beds in your assignment. And if I have two boarders and then two ER beds that I could be turning every couple hours with very sick critical patients, my boarders are going to have to wait, whether it's scheduled meds or getting them to the bathroom. Luckily, we have great techs where I work that'll help do most of those things if they can. Like, oh, we need to put them on a hospital bed to make them more comfortable, or take them to the bathroom, something like that. But like, if I get a patient in one of my ER beds that's having a heart attack, that requires all of my attention until they leave my room.
Right.
So then, yeah, my boarders will not get the attention that they need for possibly up to like 4 hours.
I see.
So it's definitely a disservice to them.
I want to go back to the other thing that you said when you were kind of laying out the job, which is people are there because they're sick and they recognize that they need help, but they're not necessarily the best shepherds of their own health to begin with.
Yeah.
And so is it like being a lifeguard for a person who's trying to drown?
Yes, a lot of times. Like I said, people are generally in better health here than they were back on the East Coast. Like, people who have COPD or heart failure, they've had these things for a better portion of their late life. Let's just say they're like 80 years old. They've probably had COPD since they were 55, 60. They've also smoked a pack of cigarettes a day, every day, for their entire life, really. Mm-hmm. And they have no desire to quit. So while I am maybe in the room next door dealing with a patient having a heart attack, they're on oxygen, they're vitally stable, they're pounding their call button because they need their nicotine patch. And then I can't get them their nicotine patch in time. So they're like, I'm leaving against medical advice because I need a cigarette. So then I have to page the doctor that's taking care of them. Because while they're an ER patient, the ER doctor is right there. But when they're a boarder, the admitting physician is usually not in the ER. They're somewhere else. So I need to page them and either get them on the phone or have them come talk to the patient, because nothing I say is going to change their mind and make them want to stay. They have to hear from their doctor. And that's most patients. They're like, you're just a nurse. What do you know?
Yeah. The addiction is driving them too at that moment.
Yeah. And it's the same with like alcoholics too.
Yeah.
Alcoholics can withdraw and very quickly be an ICU level patient. Mm-hmm. Despite what we can give them, it's not going to help their withdrawals. It's not going to help their tremors and all of the symptoms they're experiencing. So they just want to leave and drink to feel better.
I was like 16 years old. My father took me to lunch and we were heading into this diner. And this is a long time ago. So you used to walk into a diner, and in the vestibule, there were two things, like Miss Pac-Man and cigarette machines. And I would imagine most people don't even know what a cigarette machine looks like, to be perfectly honest, right? But there used to be these things you put quarters in, you pulled the lever back, and a pack of smokes would drop out of it. So my dad would go into the diner. He would put quarters in, take his cigarettes, go in and sit, and you could smoke in restaurants. So he'd sit there and smoke while he was waiting for his food. And we walk in and the machine does not have his brand, and it's out of his brand and his backup brand. For old school smokers, my dad smoked Chesterfield Kings, which were filterless cigarettes. And then in a pinch, he'd smoke a Pall Mall if he had to. I said, oh, there's no cigarettes. And he's like, yeah, he goes, it'll be fine. So we go in and we sit down, and I don't think we ordered before he broke a sweat. And then he got red in the face, and you could see the anxiety hit him. You know what I mean? And then immediately the withdrawal, and to the point where I was like, I can go across the street to the gas station and get cigarettes for you. And he goes, no, don't worry about that. And then 2 minutes later, he's pulling money out of his pocket. Go get those cigarettes for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how it is for drinkers too. Mm-hmm. Except I feel like the symptoms of withdrawal are like, they're much worse. It's almost like having like the flu, like you'll get a fever.
Yeah.
You'll be having like the cold sweats, vomiting, hallucinations. Like they are very time intensive patients. And in the hospital, everyone is so worried about falls because if a patient is there for something and they fall while they're there, whether they sustain an injury or not, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And especially when they're hallucinating, they're vomiting, they have to go to the bathroom frequently. They're always trying to get out of bed.
Yeah.
There are huge fall risks. So you either need a tech or a sitter to sit with them, or you need to be within earshot. They're very time intensive.
Call don't fall.
Yeah. Call don't fall. Stay with me.
Call don't sue us.
Exactly. Call don't fall and give yourself a brain bleed.
So here's what I'm getting. By the way, have we even touched on the things you were going to talk about?
No, not at all.
All right, go to that stuff, then I'll go back to my thing. What did you want to talk about?
So I tell type 1 patients all the time that I understand their frustrations and how the hospital does a huge disservice to well-controlled diabetics. I hear that. I know it. I personally, relating to the previous ER nurse that was on the podcast, similarly, I don't want to be admitted to the hospital. I know it's going to do bad things for my control. But I do trust about 90% of my coworkers to take great care of me, including our physicians.
You heard the nurse who said, I wouldn't go to my own ER if I had a problem for my diabetes.
Correct.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I would absolutely go to my own ER. It might have something to do with personalities. Obviously, I don't know the other nurse that was on here, but I am very open about my diabetes. I tell everyone I work with, please ask me questions if it's going to help you understand something better or help a patient. I often get text messages and phone calls while I'm off saying like, hey, my patient has an insulin pump or like a CGM. How do I take it off? Which if a patient isn't able to tell a nurse how to take their pump off, that pump absolutely needs to come off because obviously they're not going to be able to do what they need to do to manage it. Mm-hmm. And on the same hand, there's also an admitting physician at my hospital. We'll call her Dr. Jones. She is a huge advocate for type 1s as well. And she has an excellent order set for pharmacy for patients to keep their insulin pumps. Mm-hmm. So anytime I have a type 1 patient and she is not the admitting physician, I message the admitting physician and say, please consult with Dr. Jones for this patient's insulin pump orders. And I would say probably 60% of the time it happens. But that's, again, only when patients are like alert and oriented enough to tell me like their settings and stuff like that. There have been plenty of instances where a patient tells me that they want to keep their insulin pump, but they have to get in contact with their endocrinologist to find out their settings. And I was like, I've had Omnipod, t-slim, and Medtronic in my 20-some years of diabetes. If you don't know how to find the settings in your pump, that's alarming to me.
Yeah.
And I don't feel comfortable letting you keep your pump if you don't know how to find your settings.
Right. I wish you wouldn't have said Dr. Jones, by the way, because it made me think of Indiana Jones. And then it made me think that I wonder if people know that Indiana was the dog in the family. Never mind. And then that's what happened to me while I was listening to you just now. So you're telling me that if someone comes in with a complete inability to even understand their device, how are you supposed to believe they know what they're doing?
Exactly.
Okay. And so they're set up and they've probably got a rhythm going and they, you know, they push this button, they say this much for this meal, but they really don't know what's happening. This is a thing that's been set up for them and it's running, but they couldn't be the stewards of it. So this is an interesting problem because all of these problems are multifaceted. I'm gonna tell you that, you know, the first half hour of this conversation, what I heard was that nurses, people, doctors, and the system are all entities that have multiple variables impacting them.
Yes.
And depending on your perspective, like you could go into an ER and be me with my kid, and I'll be able to say that nurse doesn't know anything about diabetes. And I'll be right because I know a lot about it. And then there could be another person that goes in there that can't find the settings on their pump who would think that you know a ton about diabetes because you know more than they do. So it's varying levels of understanding coupled with your perspective, your desire, and then all these things have to come together over and over again between you and the nurse who is also sitting on four other beds and has the pressure of moving people out, holding people who can't leave but can't go upstairs, and if there is an emergency, abandoning all those other people to get to that emergency. And then on top of that, what you have is that adrenaline. This isn't even the job you wanted. The doctor's an asshole. Like, all the other things that could possibly come with this are impacting you while you're trying to help those four people, and three of them probably don't even want to help themselves.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
There are so many moving parts to being a nurse, being a doctor, being a patient. Like, it is impossible. Like, there's no one size fits all. Yeah. As we all know, like, diabetes is so complex and different from person to person. And like, I tell all of my coworkers, my diabetes is different based on the week of the month. Yeah. Whether I'm on my period or I'm ovulating or I'm working night shift or I'm working day shift, everything is different. So if I'm here for like appendicitis or I broke my arm, it's going to be different. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not even going to be able to control it well.
Yeah.
So why should I expect them to?
It's interesting. But you can see the other side of it too, right? Like, if I was just an everyday,
absolutely.
I'm an everyday person and I have type 2 diabetes. I'm not doing a great job with it. My A1C is in the nines, and I'm having some obvious health issues, metabolic issues, and some other things. It led me to the emergency room. When I get there, I'm probably hoping you're going to tell me how to keep this from happening again. And you're probably thinking, even if I knew what to tell this person, they wouldn't do it anyway.
Or even if we know what to tell this person, we tell them and they're still not going to do it anyway.
Or even understand at times.
Yeah.
Yeah. The problem is people.
Yes.
But on all sides of the problem. We're having a problem of humanity is what we're having.
Yes. Okay. We're very stubborn beings.
Yeah. In the past, if you had a mental health concern, you didn't really go to a regular hospital. There were other facilities. We don't really do that anymore. So everybody goes to a centralized place. So there used to be, there'd be a trauma center for trauma. There'd be, you know, a regular like local hospital for, you know, regular old problems. There'd be a mental health facility for mental health problems. These people would mostly be filtered in through EMS or police, so they could take them to the right places. And now everything happens in one spot, and everybody's expected to be able to deal with all of it.
So yes and no.
Okay.
There are ambulatory places, like you can just walk into a mental health facility. Depending on the type of crisis you're having, they're going to send you to the ER anyway to make sure it's not a medical emergency first.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if someone is extremely intoxicated on drugs or alcohol, they can't be in those mental health facilities. Because if they were to withdraw, it would be a medical emergency. Ooh, and they would okay. be at an inappropriate place, which is fair. A lot of people get really bogged down by the mental health patients coming into the ER. But sometimes we find that it's not a mental health crisis. You can have hallucinations because you have a brain tumor, mm-hmm. not because you're bipolar or schizophrenic.
I see. So you like the idea that they come to a centralized place where everybody, where people have like a medical background?
Yes. I like it to the extent of medically clearing and then getting them out as soon as they're medically clear, which doesn't happen. Patients can be medically cleared and then still sit in the ER for 48 to 72 hours before an inpatient bed opens up in a mental health facility.
So do we have a lack of facilities or too many people who need them?
Both.
I never have one of these conversations and feel good when they're over, by the way.
I know.
Yeah, I'm never like, oh, good, an answer. I've actually never had anybody give me an answer. I recorded with a CDE the other day who has type 1. And at the end, I said, what do you think the answers are? And they were like, I don't think there's any answers to this problem. I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah. It's really tough, too, because even if there were enough facilities, there wouldn't be enough nurses.
Right.
So, and the nurse shortage is not a shortage of people who want to be nurses. It's a shortage of people who want to be paid appropriately for what we're dealing with.
So it's an underpaid, you find it to be an underpaid profession? What's a nurse make?
Because I'm anonymous, I started out as, it's considered a new grad because I'm fresh out of school. Despite my years of tech experience, I'm still a new grad.
Right.
I started out at $34.04 an hour. I got a significant lump sum to move as far as I did and a sign-on bonus and a housing stipend.
Okay. Slow down for a second. When you were a tech, what did you make an hour?
Oh, gosh. Around $20 an hour.
So about the same. Which, that's insane. Okay. And then for
About minimum wage where I was living, I did get benefits, but I still had to pay a significant amount out of pocket for, you know, all of the things.
Yeah. Then you became a nurse. They moved you all the way up to 34.04. That 04 is insulting, by the way. 34.04 to be a nurse. And then that was East Coast. Then you kind of went middle of the country.
So the middle of the country would be 34.04.
That was the
offer that I received at my old job where I was a tech was, I think, $29.
Oh, they bumped you up to 29. You said, no, I'll go. I'm going to take the extra five an hour and go to the move across the country. They also give you a bonus and a moving stipend. Would you tell me what it was?
Yeah. So my sign-on bonus was $10,000, which is taxed. My relocation bonus was $8,000, which is also taxed.
Right.
And then I got a housing stipend of $1,000 a month for 9 months, which is also taxed, but still.
So they basically gave you $27,000 taxed. I'm just going to knock 30% off of it just for the fun of it here. So, okay. And that was to move, uproot your entire life versus staying for $29 an hour.
With no sign-on bonus, no incentive to stay
nothing,
at all.
Nothing to get you moving. Do you actually still have some of that money in the bank?
Yes and no. I acquired a pretty significant amount of credit card debt during nursing school because of medical supplies. Because I had to pay rent, which where I was living, I was paying like $2,200 a month for a 600-square-foot studio. I actually sold my car and was like commuting by bike. So I didn't have a car payment and I was still struggling to make ends meet.
So you were working hard and making concessions and you still had to use credit cards to get through school.
Yeah.
And then the bonus you got to move the credit card debt wiped that out basically.
Yeah. That and like it's expensive to move. The place that I lived in when I first got here, which I actually just moved out of, I had to pay first, last, and a deposit up front to move in. And then I actually only moved here with what fit in 2 suitcases and my dog. So the moving like of things was very inexpensive. It was just my flight.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was like $8,000 up front to move into where I was living. And that doesn't count furnishing anything.
Yeah.
So
what kind of dog fits into the luggage?
He's a miniature dachshund, so he rides in the plane with me, like under the seat in front of me.
Gotcha. Okay. I was like, how are we flying with a dog? Okay, that makes sense. Wow. And then you get there, and $34.04 an hour?
Yeah, so that was that's my base pay. I've since gotten a raise because I've been here, I think it was either a market adjustment or like the annual raise that the hospital gets, which was a whopping 71 cents. And then there's also shift differentials. So I was hired as night shift, but for my first 3 months, I was on day shift for orientation. I would work between 24 and 36 hours a week. And then I also had classes. So as a new nurse, you have to do like residency classes, we call them. And it's basically just like learning how to use equipment and like basically procedures and protocols for different processes, I guess you could say. Like there was a whole seminar on like blood gases and like our DKA protocol, which is actually I love, but a lot of people find very confusing. So there's a whole class for it. And then we have classes for neonatal emergencies, trauma, if someone's in cardiac arrest, that like process. So there's a ton of classes you have to take right up front when you start as a new grad. So I was doing like 40 hours a week between classes and working at the bedside. And then once I finished all those classes, I was just at 36 hours a week and could pick up as much extra as I wanted. But once I came off orientation, I'm on night shift. So it's an additional, I think, $4.60 an hour on night shift. And if it's a night shift weekend, I believe it's 760 additional an hour. And then there's, we also have like evening shift. So 11 a.m. to 11 p.m., 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. That gets a different differential and stuff. So the only time I'm actually making 34, now 75, is if I work a 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. shift, which I'm not hired for. So that's not what I work.
So are you not making $70,000 a year even?
No.
60?
I think it's it might have been 70.
Okay.
Because I looked at my year to date, and that's including all my stipends and stuff, and I was like around 97.
And then you're going to lose about 15% in tax. I'm actually Googling this. So on 70,000, you'll lose about 15% in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
What's that, like 10 grand? Yeah. And so you're going to walk away with 60 divided by 12. Yeah. Hold on a second. 5,000 a month. How much is your rent?
So before, when I was getting my stipend, it was $2,240 because I decided I wanted a house with a yard for my dog.
Silly.
Because we were in a cooped up apartment before.
Mm-hmm.
We're back into an apartment now, but it's a much nicer one and way more than 600 square feet. So now I'm paying about $1,400.
Okay. So you're losing $1,400 off the top for rent. I got to imagine you eat food, right?
I do.
Yeah.
Yes. And
so what are you, $400 a month for food?
That's what I budget. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's what you budget. I heard what you said there. Do you have a car?
I do have a car.
Is there a payment?
Oh, there is a steep payment. Yes.
How much?
$650.
Got it. Insurance. What's that? Like $100 a month for car insurance?
$130.
Gas?
I actually don't use a ton of gas.
Fair enough. Let's say $100 a month.
Yeah.
Okay. Electric? Couple hundred?
Yeah. Let's see. My utilities. I cable, do $175 because most of it's incorporated in my $1,400 for rent.
Okay. So when you're all said and done, you have, what, like $2,000 left at the end of the month?
About, yeah.
Okay. And so you have to work a year of your life to save $25,000.
Mm-hmm. And that's if I get to save it.
Yeah, but I'm like, going to say, you're not really going to have $25,000 at the end of the month, at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah, we should ask people to be nurses. It's a great.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And like, there is a great appeal, I won't even lie, with the schedule. So keep in mind, that's an income working only 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my 97 is actually mildly skewed because I work a lot of extra.
Mm-hmm. To get to that.
Not every single week, but like around Christmas, I worked 120 hours in 10 days because I couldn't go home to see my family. My boyfriend went home to see his family, and like my friends here are from work. So I was like, I don't want to sit at home on my couch by myself on Christmas. So I'm just going to pick up extra.
I go to work. Yeah.
So yeah, I worked a lot of extra once I came off orientation. Summers are like trauma season.
Yeah.
And since I was fresh off orientation, I was like super eager to learn all of the processes, all of the equipment we use, which I now feel very comfortable and competent. And like, I am the most fit person to be in those scenarios, which is a great feeling after only being a nurse for a year. Not to like boast my britches here, but like, I feel very comfortable in my ability and my skill.
Yeah. What you're doing.
Yeah. So a lot of extra got me to 97.
Yeah, there's a lot of extra to get to that number. So I have to tell you, what strikes me over and over again while we were just doing that little exercise is that if you're helping four people in a shift, I'm guessing that the hospital's is billing those four people. And it's incredibly possible that your effort makes more money for the hospital in one day than they pay you in a year.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I mean, like, you would probably work for a percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I don't want to call it the workaround, but the way that people are making more is by leaving like nursing as a hospital employee and going to an agency. So you can do like local travel or travel nursing and you'll make just about double.
Yeah, that's insane to me. Like, why doesn't the hospital just pay their good employees and keep them?
No one knows. It's a losing battle. We've been asking this question for years. Because even before COVID, travel nurses made significantly more than staff nurses do. And you don't even have to travel. One of the travel nurses that I work with currently, he's been at my hospital for over a year, and travel nurse contracts are typically like 13 weeks. So he has to take like a week off in between, and then he just signs another contract with the same hospital.
It's not crazy to say either that if you went to your boss and said, hey, look, I'm a good employee, pay me more money, give me double, they'd say no. But you said, if you said, okay, well, I'm going to leave and go to become a travel nurse, that they'd hire you back as a travel nurse.
Oh, and they do it all the time.
I'm glad everything makes sense.
Nothing makes sense.
Yeah. Everyone jump out a window. We're in trouble. That's all. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a lot. This is exactly the same when I talk. There's a therapist that comes on, Erica. We talk about people's problems, and this is exactly how I feel at the end of the hour with her too. I'm like, it's such a multifaceted issue. Really,
like, there's so many problems with all of it, like healthcare, hospitals, nursing. There's at least 100 problems per each of those.
Yeah. So we could sit here and drill down and talk about, hey, listen, if you're going to become a nurse, maybe you should want to do it. Maybe we could drill down at the doctor's side and go, maybe you could leave your ego aside and actually, you know, stop acting like you're God's gift to this situation. You could look at the institution and say, hey, why don't you take a little less money and pay all these people so they could actually give people good service, and maybe you'd make people healthier. The patients, you could say, hey, what if you had a basic understanding of common ideas about health and took care of yourself a little bit?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. The lack of knowledge that I didn't understand that most people had about their body is absolutely insane to me. Like, obviously I've been a diabetic for just over 20 years. I had no idea that most people didn't know how to read a nutrition label. One of my friends is a teacher for they call it a nursing program, but it's for high schoolers. So it's a tech center type situation where they go there for their senior year of high school and get a CNA, your nursing assistant. You can do cosmetology. You can do diesel mechanic. There's all different types of skills you can go and do. So she teaches the, I'm doing air quotes, nursing program there. And one of her students is a type 1. So of course she called me and was like, hey, do you drink Powerade and Gatorade and stuff regularly? And I was like, no, I think this year was the first time in my entire life I had a Gatorade that wasn't the zero or G2 or whatever it's called.
Right.
And she's like, yeah, my type 1's been drinking it almost every day. And I asked her if she was doing insulin for it. And she said, no. So she took the Powerade bottle and looked at the nutrition label. And she's like, it said 36 grams. And I was like, yeah, and that's only per serving. And there's 2 servings in that bottle.
Or sometimes 2.5 servings in the bottle.
Yeah. And she was absolutely blown away by that. And I'm like, yeah, that's you have to look at the servings. Okay. She was like, well, I never really thought about that. I'm like, oh, the luxuries of not being a diabetic.
Not being I saw somebody eating nachos, right? And from a restaurant. They give you a bowl of queso. Mm-hmm. It's like a softball size of liquid cheese. And I thought, that's more liquid cheese than you're supposed to eat in 5 years. And no. And they're just in there dipping and eating and dipping and eating. I'm like, oh my God, you're going to die. You're asking.
Yeah, similarly, I went to Trader Joe's. It's probably been a while now. And they have a frozen barbecue teriyaki chicken. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of protein and not a lot of fat. And so I was checking out and they're like, oh, why do you get this over the orange chicken? I'm like, oh, it's 20 grams less fat per serving. And they're like, oh, interesting. I've never even looked at the label. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Because the orange glaze is sugar. And then your body metabolizes the sugar and makes it and stores it as fat. And these are not big ideas. So
not at all. And it's so I don't know why anything surprises me anymore. Especially working in the ER, maybe it's because in the ER, I expect people to not know things. Mm-hmm. But out in the real world, I think these people have made it this far. They know basic things, but they don't.
Yeah.
And it shocks me every time.
Yeah. Don't stop being shocked. It's about opportunity to learn things.
Yes.
And it's the stuff that no one talks. People don't talk about this stuff. They don't. You make a baby, you feed it something you can afford, you make a little more money or you don't, that's the way your food goes. You're not a nutritionist. You've never, nobody's ever talked to you about this before. And all of a sudden, healthy just means, you know, this is what we eat.
Yeah. Healthy means like alive and not having to see a doctor frequently.
Right. It's the same exact problem as when I say to somebody, hey, like, how's your A1C? And they go, oh, it's good. Like, I learned in the beginning of making the podcast not to stop at that. I'd say, what is it? What's the number? Because the astonishing number of people who would tell me that their A1C was good, but then told me it was 8.5, I was like, well, good compared to what? And they'd say, well, good compared to where it started. Where it started, I was like on 11. Now it's at 8.5. I'm doing good. And I'm like, no, you're doing better. Words are important. And, you know, like you're doing better, you're not doing good. Good is, you know, in the fives.
Yeah.
Pretty good's in the sixes. I need help is in the sevens. 8.5 is not, I'm doing pretty good. You know, no. You know, 8.5 is I'm going to be in this emergency room one day with, you know, some sort of, and they don't know that. They don't know that if a type two, for example, lives with an 8.5 A1C their whole life, that by the time they're in their 50s, they are 100% going to be in an emergency room talking to you.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. And it's not even likely going to be a diabetes crisis.
Right.
It's going to be a secondary problem.
Renal, like cardiac.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And a little blister on their foot that's now turning black and they can't feel it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Right. Like, and all the stuff that comes along with that, that nobody, you can say nobody teaches you, but you know what? The stuff I know about diabetes, I had to teach myself.
And is it they didn't teach you or you weren't willing to learn?
And I do want to say, and sometimes people don't have the capacity. I don't mean that in a harsh way. Like, there's some people who just, their minds don't work that way. You know what I mean? They're not going to be inquisitive about things. They maybe don't have, you know, that kind of desire. It's not, I don't think of that as purposeful, by the way. Like, that's where I want somebody to step in and do something.
Right.
Yeah. And it's funny because in my heart, I want the person at the hospital to step up and go, hey, here are the things you probably don't know about your life and health, except what you're telling me is that even if you did that, you think what you'd get mostly is, go to hell, give me a pill, I got to get out of here.
Exactly. Yeah. That is exactly right. Like, okay. I am always stunned by people who come to us for help and then refuse what we're offering because they read somewhere on the internet that this is a better option and that's what they want. And we always kind of joke as nurses, like, this isn't the drive-through. You don't get to come here and tell us what you want when you're asking for our help. Because if you knew what you needed and were capable of getting it, you wouldn't be coming to us for it. You
wouldn't be here.
Like,
yeah, this is a never-ending circle.
Yeah, we get traumas that come in all the time. And granted, they might not be the most severe trauma they've ever sustained, but they were transferred to us either from an outside hospital or from the scene based on the mechanism of injury. And they decided that they needed a higher level of care, of trauma care, which is us. And it's typically with spinal injuries. Mm-hmm. So this one very specific one I'm thinking of, this man was on a trampoline. His two small children were there. I think they were like 5 and 8, maybe. And he dove into a shallow pool off of the trampoline and had temporary paralysis. And his kids had to pull him out of the water.
Oh.
He came to us with a neck brace on. We call them C collars, a cervical collar. And he kept nodding yes and no. And it was making me so angry because I'm like, if you have a spinal, specifically a cervical spinal fracture, and you keep nodding yes and no, you could be paralyzed forever. And I probably overstepped a little bit here. We were over in CAT scan. I told him many times to stop nodding yes and no. I grabbed his cheeks and got really close to his face. And I was like, you have small children at home. I don't want to see you paralyzed because you aren't listening to me.
Stop nodding
yes and no. Yeah. And like a tear just like rolled down his face and he stopped. And I was like, I'm sorry I had to say it that way, but we see this all the time.
Yeah.
You're here for a reason.
Mm. Yeah. It's so funny. It's funny because I see like both sides of, like you said, like, you know, you're here and you're not going to do the thing. But that person could easily make the argument, and a very real argument, no one's ever told me that before. I know you think it's something I should know, but I don't know that thing. And no one's ever said it. So that's where we're at, where it's an impasse. Like, medical people should be telling every person that they intersect the thing that they need to hear. And either that person takes that information and does something with it or they don't. But you don't have the time for that. So you're going off of what you mostly see. And that's how the people who could be helped get missed.
Exactly. Yeah. Like he was transferred from another hospital that was letting him like walk around and like go to the bathroom. And I was like, you absolutely will not be getting upright until we have your CT results. They transferred you here because we know more than they know. And we are going to treat you the way that we are supposed to treat you. And that, I'm sorry, is not going to make you very happy, but you have to listen to us. Right. And he was like, okay, you're right. And I was like, huh, am I? Really?
So Mimi,
like,
what should I do?
No patient's ever told me that before.
I fill up my car with those little packing peanuts, right? And that way, if I have an accident, nothing happens to me. And then I never leave the ground floor of my house and get a house with no steps in it. And then I try to stay out of the, and I don't eat 17 servings of Gatorade and I try to stay out of the hospital. This is what I'm trying to do.
And a softball size of melted cheese.
Melted cheese. Ask yourself, why does the cheese not coagulate?
Yeah.
Why? It's liquid. How is it doing that?
Right. It was solid at one point and cheese now it's liquid and it's not going back to solid. Like, what's happening?
Ask yourself what's in it.
Yeah.
Why is it staying liquid like this? Oh. Okay. All right. I'm done. Good. Thank you. did I miss any? I'm out of my mind with this. Why did I think this was a good idea? Why did I think having people on to tell me what was wrong was going to be a great idea for me? It's bad for my soul.
It's bad for everyone's soul and our mental health, because I can say all of these things until I'm blue in the face and nothing will change.
Nothing will change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then this is for the people who are going to take some sort of control of themselves and their lives and try to avoid this stuff.
Yeah, now,
having said this, and I do like to reiterate this every time I can think of, if I'm having an actual emergency, I should still go to the hospital, though.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't want to like drag anybody, but in our Facebook group for the podcast, there's people all the time like questioning certain things, like if they should go to the hospital. And more often than not, I'm like, oh my gosh, is this even a question? Mm-hmm. Like, I cannot believe that people would think not to. But I've also worked in other ERs where I can absolutely see how going to the ER would be doing a disservice to them.
Yeah.
But especially adults in DKA, we are not resilient like children are. Like when I was diagnosed, my blood pH was 6.9, which is not survivable. Like that is not compatible with life. Mm-hmm. So if my pH were 6.9 now, I would likely be dead. As a kid, you're much more resilient. You bounce back. Your body can compensate a little bit better. But as an adult, if I even, like if I'm sick, and even if I don't have ketones, my blood sugar's fine. If I throw up, I get very nervous. Like, okay, if my blood sugar goes low and I can't keep anything down, emergency. If my blood sugar's high, I'm giving myself insulin. It's not coming down. I'm throwing up. Emergency. Like, I see that all the time, so I understand I have a different understanding of it, but it is frightening. And like, we are very fragile people, like not diabetics, but just humans. Like humans are fragile. You don't have those compensatory mechanisms that children have. So if something goes sideways, it can go sideways and stay sideways forever. Like some things you just like can't come back from. Like, I'm always scared, like, oh, one more, like, run-in with DKA, kidney failure, or retinopathy. Like, there's so many irreversible things that can happen.
Yeah.
Heart attacks and strokes, especially because we're diabetics. Like, we're very fragile.
Right. For my money, I like being prepared ahead of time. I have a small group of good doctors that are local to me that we have, you know, become patients of, so that when we have certain problems, we're not searching. First of all, we know where to go to get somebody to help. Those same doctors can be helpful for you when you're going to emergency situations as well. You'd be surprised that calling your GP, who is actually a good person, saying, hey, here's what's wrong with me. I'm going into the hospital. Could you call over there and let them know I'm coming? That actually helps. Getting to a hospital system where your doctor is affiliated with, that helps. There's little things that you can do to be ready. You could also you know, do a little bit of research so that you know how things are handled at certain emergency room situations. Like, what are they going to do for me if I come in there and DKA? How are they going to handle this? What do they know about this? I don't know. I like to be as prepared as possible without being a prepper. I don't have a truck with a 700-gallon gas tank on it that only pulls fresh water in case zombies come or anything like that. But I do know where I would go if there was a problem.
Right.
And, you know, even at that, you don't realize that you could be 3 miles from 4 hospitals and only one of them's a decent hospital and you wouldn't know the difference.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, I am always stunned. There's a few very, very, very small hospitals that are not associated with any larger hospitals nearby currently. And they transfer patients to us all the time. And I'm like, it's a miracle this patient made it to us alive. Like, I didn't even know that this place existed until right now. They're telling me that this hospital down the street was taking care of this patient and they're like knocking on death's door. And I'm like, how are they allowed to be a hospital? Like, how have they kept their doors open for this long? Mm-hmm. And God forbid a patient who doesn't know anything about the area has a medical emergency and goes there. Like, it is terrifying to me.
Yeah.
Granted, we do have a large hospital. We have two very large main hospital systems here that span, I believe each of the two systems has at least 4 emergency rooms and 2 major hospitals. There's plenty of resources around. And if you were visiting the area and you Googled ER near me, it's not going to take you to that little rinky dink one that scares me.
Yeah.
It's going to take you either to my hospital or our neighboring hospital, which both can provide excellent care. It's astounding.
I would like to remind people at the end here that you are a human being with all the fragility and that comes with that. And so is the person you're going and asking them to help you. Those people are people. You're a person. You have limitations. They have limitations. The best thing you can do is know as much about your situation as possible. Advocate for yourself till the very end. Never give in. You know what I mean? Always push. Yeah. And at the same time, remember, you're just asking another person. It's not like Mimi's not a magic fairy. She's a girl who wanted to make a little more money. So she became an RN. And then she moved across the country to make $6 more an hour. And she just wants to go home with her dog and not sit on her sofa and be bored.
Yeah.
And have some grass to run in, just like you.
Exactly.
She's not a wizard. You're not going to a wizard and telling them that you know, please grant my wish for me. I'd like to feel better now. So anyway, whatever. I'm sure people are going to hate me by the time this is over, but I appreciate you doing this very much. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And on the same note there, like the rinky dink hospital I'm talking about, that is not an attack towards their staff at all. It's just like a lack of resources and a lack of exposure to a lot of stuff. Like,
yeah.
They can be very competent nurses and doctors, but they don't have the exposure to what other nurses and doctors have or the resources to adequately treat these patients. So like, they're not bad providers. They're just in a bad situation, I feel like.
And once you get there, you're in that situation right along with them.
Yeah.
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 Okay. I appreciate this. Did you enjoy being called Mimi?
I do enjoy being called Mimi.
All right. Well,
maybe if I'm ever a grandma, I'll go by Mimi.
Well, yeah, first we got to get you out of that apartment with just you and that dog, or that's not going to happen. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. It was good talking to you.
You too. Arden has been getting her diabetes supplies from US Med for 3 years. You can as well. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. My thanks to US Med for sponsoring this episode and for being longtime sponsors of the Juice Box podcast. There are links in the show notes and links at juiceboxpodcast.com to US Med and all of the sponsors. A huge thank you to one of today's sponsors, Gvoke Glucagon. Find out more about Gvoke HypoPen at gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. You spell that gvokeglucagon.com/juicebox. A diabetes diagnosis comes with a lot of new terminology, and that's why I've created the Defining Diabetes series. These are short episodes where Jenny Smith and I go over all of the terms that you're going to hear living with diabetes. And some of them that you might not hear every day. From the very simple bolus up to feet on the floor. Don't know the difference between hypo and hyper? We'll explain it to you. These are short episodes. They are not boring. They're fun. And they're informative. It's not just us reading to you out of the dictionary. We take the time to chat about all of these different words. Maybe you don't know what a Kussmaul respiration is. You will when you're done. Ever heard of glycemic index and load? Haven't? Doesn't matter. You'll know after you listen to the Defining Diabetes series. Now, how do you find it? You go to juiceboxpodcast.com, up top to the menu, and click on Defining Diabetes. You'll be able to listen right there in your browser, or you'll see the full list of the episodes and be able to go into an audio app like Apple Podcasts or Spotify and listen to them at your pace. Download them into your phone and listen when you can. The Defining Diabetes series is made up of 51 short episodes that will fast forward your knowledge of diabetes terminology. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of Cold Wind. If you're looking for community around type 1 diabetes, check out the Juice Box Podcast private Facebook group, Juice Box Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes. But everybody is welcome. Type 1, type 2, gestational, loved ones, it doesn't matter to me. If you're impacted by diabetes and you're looking for support, comfort, or community, check out Juice Box Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes on Facebook. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.